Welcome to Writer Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis. You can check out my books and social media at mindymcginnis.com and visit the Writer Writer Pants on Fire blog at writerwriterpantsonfire.blogspot.com. Today's guest is Jodi Casella, author and former high school English teacher. Her YA novel, Thin Space, received a starred review from Kirkus. She blogs, reviews books, speaks at libraries and schools, and teaches workshops at the Thurber House in Columbus, Ohio. She is the regional director of the Ohio Central South region of SCBWI. Jodi joined me to talk about MFAs, querying as an already published writer, and the subjective book-choosing process of readers. Tell us about your journey as a writer, what your background was, if you had any training in writing before you dove in, your query journey, how you made the transition from an aspiring writer to a published one.
I think I always wanted to be a writer. I can remember writing when I was 7 years old, probably right when I learned how to write, writing stories. And it was something that I always did. For me, it was probably the only thing that I felt like I was good at. And writing back then was not something you did in school. We didn't write the way they do now. We wrote essays maybe or book reports, but we didn't write the way kids do now. So writing was just for me. I always kept a journal. I wrote stories. I wrote a book when I was 14. It was just my little personal thing that I enjoyed doing. And when I got to college, I majored in creative writing and really seriously for the first time thought I could do this maybe. But the only model that I had for being a professional writer was being a poet, because that's what my professors were. They were poets. So I thought, well, I guess that's what I have to do. I have to be a poet and a professor. I started working on an MFA in poetry. And then I think I just had this moment of panic thinking, am I really going to be a poet? Is that really a practical thing? So I quit and got my certification in teaching and became a high school English teacher and just sort of put writing aside. It was a fun thing I did when I was a kid, but it didn't seem like a thing you could make a living at. I went back to it later. I think I was bored. I think I was, you know, had missed writing. I started getting stories published in Highlights and in Cicada magazine, which is part of Cricket magazine group. And that was an ego booster for me because I thought, well, maybe I can do this. They used to pay better back when I first started having stories published. They paid pretty well. Then I started writing novels. I think I thought that I could very easily transition from writing stories to writing novels and learned that I was wrong about that. I wrote 5 books and queried them and got rejected, just tons of rejections before I got an agent. So it took 5 books of practice, learn how to write a novel before I wrote my book Thin Space, which ended up being published. So my query process, I think I've heard you talk before it on panels. You wrote several books before your first breakout book.
Not a Drop to Drink was the 5th for me as well. The 5th one that I wrote.
I've talked to a lot of writers and most of them will say 3rd, 4th, 5th book. I've only met one person who their first book was their first published book, but they had been writing professionally in other ways. So
it's interesting to me that you started out wanting to write poetry, because if any genre is hard to break into and very hard to make any money in at all, yeah, it would be poetry. So yes, I can see that starting out thinking that you wanted to make a living as a poet, I can't think of anyone other than obviously poet laureates.
No, I don't think anybody makes a living being a poet. I think that my models were people who were professors who wrote poetry. And so they would call themselves poets, but they were making their money as teachers. That was the way I thought you would have to do it. Poetry, it's sad that it's not more respected in this country or read. I wish I did stick with the MFA, though. I wish I got it. I wish I saw it through and finished it, because I think even the time that I spent working on that really helps my writing now.
Certainly. I know a lot of writers that have MFAs that say, even though perhaps if you took the money that they put into it and you balance it against what they make, that it isn't necessarily a win situation, but that it did improve their writing.
There's very few things that you could say you have to do this in order to be a writer. I don't even know if there's anything you could say you have to do. I know a lot of people who don't have English degrees or don't even have college degrees. It doesn't matter. If you're a reader, you can be a writer.
I agree. There might even be writers that I know of that I really respect that don't even have high school diplomas. If you have that knack, if you have that talent, and as you say, most of them are voracious readers, that's your education.
Right. Maybe that's the only thing that gives you the model for story structure and like understanding what works and what doesn't work, even if you're not consciously thinking about it. I think most writers were readers.
How did you get your agent? Was it through querying? Was it through contests? Was it through conference attendance? How did that happen for you?
I would go to a bookstore and pull books out of the shelf that looked like books that were similar to what I was trying to do. And I would flip to the back, see the acknowledgement page, and see if that person mentioned who their agent was. Because a lot of times writers will thank their agent. I think this was kind of right on the edge of when you could find all this stuff online, kind of a low-tech way of finding out who people's agents were. And I started making a list that way, and then I started cold querying. But I had also met people at conferences. I'd gone to writing conferences, and so I would meet agents at conferences. I was also submitting to editors, too, because this was kind of right at the time, too, where a lot of houses were still open to unagented writers. You could submit directly to an editor. You can't really do that anymore, but you could when I was doing this. But how I got my first agent was a friend of mine who worked at Random House recommended me to someone. She had just joined an agency, and she had been a book buyer for Ingram, which is a big book distributor. And he said, this person is looking for clients. And so that was how I got my first agent. Not to go into all the details, but she ended up leaving the industry, and I have a new agent now that I got through, again, like the kind of querying. This time around, trying to get an agent once you have a book published, it was hard, but I felt like I had more contacts and more understanding of the industry. It took a while, but it was still me just sending out queries to people. I have a new agent now, and it came from the query process.
How many queries did you send as a published writer?
So the first time I probably sent several dozen. I know that this isn't a lot when I hear other people's stories. I've heard writers talk about submitting like 100 queries. My first one probably was like 2 or 3 dozen. The second time it was number 13. In some ways it was easier because I got a lot of people who requested my manuscript. They requested the full, and I had some choices that I didn't have the first time around. It still took 13 queries, and there were still some people who didn't respond at all. I think that's one thing that people don't understand is how many rejections you're going to get, how many no responses you're going to get. Even when someone requests it and you think, oh my gosh, this is it, that may not lead to anything, which, not to make people feel depressed about it, but I think it helps so that you don't take it as personally, that it's pretty common.
I had multiple partials and fulls go out that did not receive offers for representation. And it gets your hopes up, but it also is a good way to judge what's working and what's not working. If you are getting many requests for partials or fulls, it means that your query is working. And if you're getting rejections with all of those pages out there, it means your manuscript isn't. And so it gives you a good idea of what needs work yet. You have to be able to take those punches. And that's, I think, the biggest thing for aspiring writers to learn. I was talking to one of my earlier guests, and they said that they didn't like the idea of everyone says you have to have thick skin. She said, I don't have thick skin. I feel everything. It hurts, but I keep going. And I was like, well, that's a better way to put it, is that you can take the pain.
I think in this business, and maybe any creative business, it's hard not to take it personally because it's your work that came out of you, and it does feel personal. But at the same time, there's so much rejection in any creative industry, and there's some things that people just don't like. It's just subjective. Mm-hmm. You know, I just don't like classical music, or I don't like jazz, or, you know, I mean, it has nothing to do with the performance. And so the query process, I think, prepares you for the whole thing. It, you know, you're going to get rejections in the query process. You're going to get rejections when your agent submits your manuscript. There's going to be editors who reject it. When it gets published, there's going to be reviewers who don't like it, or bloggers or readers who just say, this is awful. So that just goes with it. If you can't handle that first rejection, you're going to have a really hard time over the long term with what's coming.
You have to be able to process criticism, but you also have to be able to process attacks, because there are reviews that are not critical, they're attacking. And my advice is don't read your reviews, because there's no benefit to it. If it's positive, it just makes you rest on your laurels. And if it's negative, there's no response from you that is acceptable. So you aren't allowed to interact, and you're just going to stew, and it's going to upset you and throw you off balance. It's just not worth it. There's no perceived benefit, I think, in reading your own reviews.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, I think I read the first few that came in because I was curious, and you're right. I think the reviews are for readers, and I like reading reviews as a reader to see, is this the book I would like? Or if I read a book and I had an issue with it, or I liked it, and I think, what did other people say about this? Just out of curiosity, a conversation you could have with readers about a book you're still thinking about. For a writer, you're right. It doesn't really do anything.
I will read reviews of other books. So, for example, if I'm reading a book and I think, wow, the way that they handled this was amazing, I wonder if other people picked up on this. Or I will think, you know, this isn't quite doing for me what everyone else seems to say. And I will look and see if there was another critical review that said, you know, this didn't quite hit the way it was supposed to, the way everyone else said it did. So I will read reviews of other books just to see if I'm way out in left field as my reaction as a reader. That's always after I read the book. I don't actually depend on reviews to lead me to any type of fiction. I depend on word of mouth. What are you reading? I have friends that read widely in genres that I don't necessarily wander into very often. I'm starting to read more women's fiction. I have a friend that reads it all the time. She was on the podcast, Kate Carey's Quinn. She loves women's fiction. And I was like, hey, tell me what to read. I will ask other people. I don't use professional reviews or blog reviews or reader reviews, because I rely on other people that I know have good taste to tell me what to read.
Yeah, no, I do that too. I mean, it's such a personal thing what you're going to pick up next anyway. And even when people recommend things, sometimes you're just not in the mood. That makes me feel better when I think about my own book out there. Again, it's not a personal thing if someone picks it up or doesn't pick it up, or if they pick it up and put it down. It's just the way we are as readers. It's a very subjective, personal thing.
Up next, the benefits of joining SCBWI, the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, and how attending book festivals geared for readers can also be beneficial to writers. If you like what I do here on the podcast, please consider a monetary donation. Visit patron.podbean.com/writer-writer-pants-on-fire, where you can pledge as little as $1 a month, which will get you a shout out on the Writer Writer Pants on Fire blog. For $5 a month, your name will be added to an episode in thanks. For $10, you can suggest a topic or ask questions for the end of the month guest-free show. $20 a month will get you access to a monthly chat with me, the host, Mindy McGinnis. Or if you're a writer looking for some advertising space, an editor or copy editor looking to share your services with writers, a one-time payment of $20 will buy you a 30-second ad space here on the show. Again, visit patron.podbean.com/writer-writer-pants-on-fire to help keep this podcast on the air. I want to talk a little bit about SCBWI, the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. You are a chapter president here in Ohio. Tell our listeners more about what the group in general does nationally and what it has to offer members. I'm a member. Tell us a little bit about what the benefits are of membership to SCBWI.
SCBWI is a worldwide children's book organization for writers, illustrators, editors and agents join, librarians join, anybody who are big fans of children's books, people at all stages of the journey, whether you're a beginning writer or you're multiply published, are part of this organization. It's been around since the early 1970s. There's 22,000 members, 70 regional chapters. I'm actually a regional advisor. The way they do it is if you join the organization, you are put into a geographical region, and then that region will have activities and events and workshops and speakers and meetings. You also get the benefit of being part of the international organization and go to their conferences. They have a conference going on right now in LA where they have writers, authors, and agents and editors come and speak and do panels and presentations. there is a big benefit in joining. It's one of the reasons why I am a regional advisor is because I felt that when I first started out as a writer, I've been a member for 12 or 13 years. And when I joined, someone had told me, if you are serious about being a writer, this is the professional organization for you, a children's writer or an illustrator. This is the place to be. And I took that seriously and I joined and started going to their conferences and meeting people. And it is a good way to kind of network, meet people who are doing kind of the same thing that you are or want to do the same thing, seeing people who've made it. So you kind of have a model and find a mentor, seeing people in the industry like agents and editors and getting contacts that way, because they'll speak to you. They'll be open to your queries after a conference. So that's really helpful. I felt like after I joined, it helped put me on the path to publication. And so now when this position opened up in Ohio, so our region that you belong to and that I belong to is Ohio Central Southern, and it covers Cincinnati, Columbus, and Dayton area. We probably have like 500 members. I wanted to give back to the group, which is why I agreed to work as the regional advisor. It's a volunteer position, and it's a lot of fun organizing events, being on the other side of the table, I guess.
I know that when I attended the national convention in New York, the winter convention in New York, I think it was in 2013. What blew my mind about that convention was the people who are not only established, but superstars in the children's publishing industry who are just in the crowd and they're just mingling. I was sitting at one of the sessions, I believe Margaret Peterson Haddix was speaking. There was a gentleman that walked past me and he said, "Oh, is that seat open?" And I'm like, "Yes, of course, go ahead." And he sat down next to me and I glanced at his name tag and it was Bruce Coville. And I was just like, "Holy shit, I'm sitting next to Bruce Coville." You know what I mean? Like, I was just completely blown out of my mind. And that happened at multiple points. I would just be moving around in a crowd or, you know, making eye contact and saying hello. And then I would glance at the name tag and it would be someone just ridiculously famous. And I'm like, "Oh my God." Right. It blew my mind.
I was in an elevator with Jane Yolen and it was just the two of us. And she was going to speak later. And I was like, "Oh, it's Jane Yolen." And like, you want to say something. They have people who are very much like what we think of as the big names in the children's book industry. And they feel the same way I do about it. They came up through SCBWI and now they want to give back. And that's why they always go to the conferences and do presentations. It is a really good organization. So I'm hoping, like, my goal for Ohio is just making sure that we have a lot of good programming for people at all stages of the journey. That's actually one of the harder challenges of running the group, is because people are coming into it from all these different places. I mean, some people are just thinking, "I want to write a book," and they don't know anything about the children's book industry. People like you who have multiple books out. So it's trying to meet the needs of those people. And then, of course, illustrators, Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, that's part of the group. And so we have illustrators too. And we want to make sure that there's programming that meets their needs as well. It's always a challenge to kind of come up with speakers that will be of interest to everyone, which doesn't always happen, but that's my goal.
I'm sure that would be very difficult because, like you said, not only do you have a variety of people at the levels of beginners to accomplished, but you also have everyone from picture book to YA. And those are really, really different areas, completely different skill sets. And then, of course, illustrators, which is a different animal entirely. So, yeah, I think that that would be incredibly challenging to present something for everyone. Do you have a hard time balancing that, as you said, a volunteer position with your own writing?
I would say every week, I probably spend between 5 and 10 hours on answering emails from people who will contact the chapter, setting up contracts for speakers that are going to come, and handling the money. I'm the one that has to handle the bills. It's a nonprofit organization, but we have money coming through to pay our speakers. 5 to 10 hours a week, that's not a ton of time, really. The benefit is, you know, I can go to the conferences for free. I was thinking about what you said when you have like all these different interests and coming at it from different areas. But the way that I kind of look at it is we're all interested in telling stories for children. So whether you're writing for the teen audience or picture books or nonfiction or you're illustrating, you're trying to tell stories to children. And mm-hmm. so if you keep that in mind, then that makes it a little bit easier when you think about the programming. You came and spoke at our region, a workshop with Kelly Barson back in March, I think it was. And there were people who came to that who were children's picture book writers. And they came mm-hmm. because they wanted to hear you and Kelly speak about writing for kids. And even if it wasn't specifically geared toward what they write, you talked about story structure and you talked a little bit about your publishing journey. And that's always of interest to people, especially who haven't crossed that threshold into publishing world yet. They want to know, mm-hmm. you know, how to do it. Probably half the people in that room were not YA writers.
I have done a couple of presentations for our group, but also for other SCBWI groups, and they've always been really well attended. I enjoy being present for SCBWI and, as you said, giving back. It did help me, for sure. I was already agented by the time I joined SCBWI, but I still benefit from it. And I read my bulletin. Whenever I get my bulletin, I read my bulletin. I know that SCBWI, you particularly, make sure that there is a table at local events like book festivals and fairs. I meet a lot of aspiring writers when I do book festivals and book fairs. I have a lot of people coming through that will say, I'm interested in writing, or I'm querying, or I have finished a novel, or I'd like to begin one. And I always enjoy talking to those people. And I usually direct them to your SCBWI table if they write for children or teens, because I find it so helpful. Do you think that that kind of interaction with authors and also with organizations at events like that, that are primarily for readers, are also really beneficial for writers?
Oh, definitely. And I recommend it to people all the time because, number one, they're free usually. What I would say to beginning writers, and when I was too, I remember going to those book fairs and thinking, you can walk right up to the writer, whether you're going to buy a book from them or not and get it signed. You can walk right up to them. Sometimes they don't have a line. Sometimes there's nobody talking to them. And so they're just sitting there and you can just pick their brain. And they're usually really happy to talk to you because they're just sitting there. And I remember, oh my gosh, it was like 20 years ago, but I remember going to a book festival and just having this long conversation with Robert Cormier. He's the one who wrote The Chocolate War. And he was just sitting at a table and I was thinking, well, I'm going to go over and talk to him, you know? And he was so nice and so pleasant. I definitely think going to a book festival, and a lot of times the book festivals, again, speaking of Ohio, because we have a lot. We have Ohioana, we have Books by the Banks, Buckeye Book Fair, probably forgetting one, but we have a lot of really good festivals here and they happen every year. There's panel discussions, and many of them are geared toward writers, where they have writers on panels answering questions about the writing process. Really, really good, thoughtful questions. I remember going to Ohioana Book Festival before my book came out and meeting the person who was in charge of programming at the Thurber House. They do programming for kids and adults. They bring writers in, speakers. They're located in Columbus. I met the person who does programming there and we got into a conversation and she ended up inviting me to do classes there. So that's how I got involved in teaching for them and doing their summer camps and stuff like that. So you never know how those encounters are going to go. And usually book festivals will have groups from the community there with their tables and that could lead to something like a teaching position like it did for me. So definitely worth your time to go if you're interested in writing.
Especially if you're in Ohio by chance. We have so many wonderful festivals. You just mentioned them. I will be at all of them. Books by the Banks. I'm at Buckeye Book Fair. I'm at Ohioana. I won't miss them. That's the three big ones. There are others that pop up, but annually, those three are the ones that are consistent and that I'll never miss.
OELMA, too, which is the Ohio
Educational Library Media Association.
Yeah, okay.
And I will be there. The conference this year is October 18th through 20th. It's in Worthington, Ohio, and I will be there. I am speaking.
I know OELMA, it's open to the public, at least part of it. I think they allow members from the public to just come and
yes, they do.
Writers who are there. Yeah.
Yes, it's lovely. I love it. some writers do not enjoy sitting behind a table for 8 hours and hawking their book. I actually like it. I enjoy sitting behind my table and talking to people and meeting people. Selling books obviously is good for me. I enjoy doing the book selling, but some people really don't enjoy that part. And I think it's important to learn how to do that, especially in your local area. It's really important. I know that the first year that I did Ohio Anna, I think I sold 7 books. It was my first year out. No one knew who I was. I only had a hardcover, so, you know, it was expensive. It was like $18. My second year out, I did better. I had 2 books. One of them in paperback. And now this past year at Ohio Anna, because the same crowd is coming back every year and they've learned who I am and what I write. And I think I sold, oh gosh, I sold over 60 books this year. Yeah. I moved books. So once you establish a readership, I mean, it's amazing. Those ripples from those 7 books that I sold in 2013 grew that much. And I think it's important. I know some people aren't comfortable with the hand selling. And I think that there are ways to, I'll even call them coping mechanisms because it is overwhelming. But there are ways to learn how to be better at that. And I think one of the most important things is meeting and knowing your fellow writers in your region. Obviously, you and I and Natalie and I don't even know how many others, Jennifer and Jeff and Liz, it's like we are all together at these events all the time. We know each other, and it helps when you're sitting next to someone and you can turn to them and have your little time out with a friend before you're face to face with the public. And it really helps. I cannot emphasize enough making friends within your writer region.
It is so important to meet the other writers, because I was saying when I first started, I didn't know anyone. I didn't have any model, role model for how do you do this life. And right. I didn't know anyone else who was doing it. And I was just sort of stumbling around in the dark. And once you meet other people, writing is such a solitary activity. It's just you and the screen. It's so helpful to meet other people who are doing the same thing. We have gotten close because I felt like when we were first doing those book festivals, it's like a almost like a circuit where you just keep running into the same people and you're going to become friends. You're sitting next to them at a table or on a panel. You know these people. It's helpful to kind of have other people's advice. I'm in another group called Oh Yeah, which is Ohio YA Writers. And it's just a group, very loose group of people that we just meet once a month for dinner and just talk about the ups and downs of what we're doing. I feel like Ohio has done a really good job, maybe because we do have so many festivals, but we do have a really close group. And I've heard from people in other states that are envious. I don't know if they don't have the same community or if they just haven't had a chance to meet each other the way we have. I don't know, but it's very, very helpful.
We have a good mix of personalities for one thing. And I do credit SCBWI. And Ohio Anna with a lot of those connections. I don't think you can emphasize enough how important community is when you're a writer. I remember when I was working on A Madness So Discreet, I was out to dinner with Jeff. It was Jeff Gerard and Cinda Williams-Chima. It was a group thing. We were all together, but the three of us were the ones that ended up sitting together at the table. Because, you know, when you have 10 or 12 people, right, you end up talking to the ones next to you. I hadn't even begun A Madness So Discreet yet. I was working through some of the ideas for it, and I was really concerned because it dealt a lot with lobotomies. That was a big part of the plot. I had just discovered that lobotomies didn't exist in the time period that I was setting the book in. I couldn't actually shift at the time. I had an idea that involved the Chicago World's Fair in the plot, which now is no longer in the plot, but at the time it was. It was part of my original pitch. So I had to set it in 1894 or 1890. Like, it had to be in that arena. And I needed lobotomies and I needed the 1890s. And I was just like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I already knew the story, but I began to think more about the story of Phineas Gage. I won't go into all the details, but he had a major brain trauma that ended up changing his personality. And this was way before that, like in the 1840s. And so I walked Jeff and Cinda through my entire logic of how a doctor in the 1890s could understand the frontal lobe and personalities and how a lobotomy would work, even if the word didn't exist yet. Right. And I walked both of them through it. And Cinda was like, well, Mindy, yes, I think that could absolutely work. And Jeff just looked at me and he went, it's fiction, right? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, who cares if it works? And I was like, I was like, okay, so I have Cinda's very rational, logical think through where she was like, yes, Mindy, that makes perfect sense. And then Jeff is like, it doesn't matter, it's fiction. And I was like, okay, well, I mean, that's two different takes where both said, yes, it works.
Yeah. That's true. Not just the commiserating about your publishing, but also bouncing off ideas, having people read early versions of your manuscript. That is so helpful too.
Next, Jodi's book, Thin Space, and a discussion about how every author's process is different, sometimes from project to project.
Let's talk about your book. Your book, Thin Space, deals with the death of the main character's twin and his subsequent need to deal with his own guilt over being the survivor of the car accident. He becomes invested in the idea of thin spaces, places where the boundaries between the living and the dead are less pronounced. Celtic legend says he can pass through such a space, but only if he is barefoot. Where did the idea for the story come from?
Sid Fleischman said that just like it takes two sticks to make a fire, it takes two ideas to make a story. So two ideas that don't seem like they have much in common kind of coming together, that's a spark for a story. And that's how it's worked for me with a lot of things that I've written. And with Thin Space, it was the same way. I had read something about the Celtic idea of thin spaces. I saw in a magazine, it was just kind of a throwaway line in an article that said that the Celts believed that there's some places on Earth where the wall between the living and dead is thinner. That just sort of stuck with me. I don't know why, but just kind of an intriguing idea that there could be places like that. At the same time that I had read that, my son was in seventh grade and he rode the school bus with a boy who was in high school who used to walk around barefoot. And I saw this kid walk off the school bus in the winter and he was wearing a coat and was barefoot. And I was so fascinated by this kid and I wanted to understand his motivation. Every day I would go to the bus stop and wait for my son to get off and I'd see this kid step off. And he was about the age of that ended up being my main character in Thin Space. He sort of stuck with me in the back of my head. This barefoot boy is what I called him. Those two ideas, the thin space and then the barefoot boy, really don't have anything to do with each other because, spoiler alert, I made up the idea that you have to be barefoot to step through a thin space. That's not really part of the Celtic legend, but
I love it.
It makes sense. It seems like it would be that way. So those two ideas came together.
That's one of those things that I love when a real life experience triggers an amazing fictional world. You can't beat that.
To me, that's the interesting part about the writing process is there's a logical aspect. There's planning, whether you're the type of writer who plots out your book ahead of time or not. I'm more of the pantser where I sort of write to see where the idea is going. Whether you do that or not, there is going to be a logical part that comes into it. It has to make sense. But then there's also this magical part that I don't think anybody can explain, where it's like, where do these ideas really come from? Why did that pop into my head? The characters sort of take on a life of their own and act in a way that you don't exactly plan, or you think you're going to write a scene a certain way and it goes into a different direction and that direction's better. That's the best part of the writing process, I think, is the unexpected things that kind of come up organically.
Organically for me is the key. I also, like you, am a strict pantser. I don't plan anything. I usually don't even know who's going to survive through the end of the book. For me, that's key. I like not knowing. If I were to plot a book, I think it would lose the interest, my own interest, because I don't know what's going to happen. And that's part of what is the drive for me to finish the book. It's like reading in a lot of ways. Do you have that experience too?
I don't know where I read this, but someone said that every book is a question. You as a writer have this question and you're trying to write the book to find the answer. So for me with Thin Space, this boy is looking for a thin space. And that was the question for me. It was why? Why is he looking for a thin space? You know, what's going to happen when he goes in? And I had no idea when I started writing the book what was going to happen. I didn't even know if there was going to be such a thing as a thin space. I thought maybe they don't really exist. It was just something that he was deluded about. And so I wrote the book to answer the question. And if you think about books that way, a lot of times that does work. Wizard of Oz, will Dorothy get home? Mm-hmm. There usually is a question. And sometimes it's stated pretty explicitly on the very first page. I'm like you, if I know everything when I start writing, I would be kind of bored. Like there'd be no reason to want to do it if you knew all the answers.
Right, right. I'm the same way. And I know many excellent writers who plot everything. My critique partner plots to an insane degree. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, I couldn't do it. But that is exactly proof that everyone has their own process. And when people ask me about my process, it's hard for me to answer, not because I don't have one, but because it is very loose and it seems to change with every book. I'm not very good at teaching writing for this reason. I think the most important thing is for everyone to realize that my way is not your way. It might be good for people, other pantsers, to hear, yeah, it's okay to have no idea and to just freewheel everything. But other people find that terrifying.
I definitely think that everyone has their own process. And I think you're right that even when you feel like you've come upon what works for you, then you write another book and then that doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. My thought is more just to be open. I love to find out how other people do it because I just think, well, that's fascinating. My initial response might be like, no, I would never outline a whole book before I start. But I'll tell you, I don't think I would ever use the word never, because if I started writing something and it wasn't working, I would be open to trying that. I think that writers, we're kind of superstitious and we want to stick with the thing that we know works for us. But if it doesn't, there's so many ways to write a book. I would think even the people who are the most logical and plot everything out, they still have to be open to things maybe veering off a little.
I think it's important for everyone to realize that the process of finding your process, it's difficult. And as you said, and I've heard other people say, that it can even change with every book. I am very, you know, I am extremely loose about my process, and I won't even start a book until I have to sometime. I remember when I first started writing, I would be 3 or 4 months ahead of my deadline. I would turn in my book and my editor would say, okay, I'm not going to get to this until your deadline, but thank you for turning it in so early. Now I'm starting the book 3 or 4 months before the deadline, because I've learned that I can write quickly. The other important key there is, though, that I have become a better drafter. My first draft that I turned in 3 or 4 months early, it was clean, but it wasn't sharp. And just through the process of learning how to draft effectively, I'm a better drafter now. So I can start a book 3 months before a deadline and know that I'll be able to turn in something that is clean and sharp. Now, that's partially also due to the effectiveness of my critique partners. I should definitely say that.
Even though you might be writing for 3 months or 4 months, there's probably a lot of subconscious work that goes on beforehand where you're sort of mulling things over. And even if you think you're not consciously thinking of it, there are little moments, because I find that I do that too. Like when I have an idea for a book, it's sort of churning around in the background of my head. So even if I'm not writing it or even talking about it or consciously thinking about it, there are things that must be working their way through, where so that when you do get to the point where you start writing, you've worked out a lot of stuff.
There's a lot of subconscious pre-writing that goes on. I'll get ideas for scenes that I will jot down. And sometimes my pre-writing is simply a Word document that has 4 or 5 sentences on it. And it'll say, do the thing with the stream and the fish.
Right.
And to me, that means something. I can get 10 pages of a novel out of that sentence. That's my process. It's extremely loose. It doesn't work for everyone, that's for sure. What do you have going on right now? What's next for you?
I have a new agent, and I'm on submission with a book that is not really like Thin Space. It's because it doesn't have a supernatural or fantasy element to it. It's just straight up realistic contemporary. And I'm really excited about it. When I read books that are hard, books that have elements to them that might be like difficult subject matter, this book actually has to do with a girl who has had some abuse in her past. And so you hear something like that and you think, I don't know if I want to read a book like that. And so it was important to me that the book had humor to it. The girl has what I hope is sort of a funny voice to her, because she uses humor to cope with her issues, and she's funny. I didn't want it to be so heavy and so hard that people wouldn't want to read it, you know? So it's a difficult topic, but the voice is a little bit lighter and it still deals with the theme.
Humor as a coping mechanism is perfectly valid. Female of the Species, I have people tell me, they're like, yeah, that book slayed me, but I also laughed out loud a couple of times. And I'm like, yeah, that's the point.
I had heard people say, oh, it's a dark book, it's a hard book, you know, and I was like, ugh. But I was immediately drawn into the voices of your characters. I was immediately drawn into the situation. I could handle it because there were parts that were funny.
You have to be able to reflect real life. And just because you have trauma or you have had a bad experience or a bad experience going on in real time at the moment, it doesn't mean that there are not humorous aspects still going on in your life. If you write something that is a complete huge downer, I don't know that that's helpful to anyone. I mean, it is in the fact that they can relate and they can say, yes, this is natural, this is normal, I'm not bad or wrong because I have this going on in my life. But you have to have those lighter moments, just like real life. If you don't have them, it's overwhelming.
And I think, like, for people who write for kids, it's really, really important that these books have some hope to them. Real life still has humor. Even in the most difficult situations, there's still going to be some hopeful moments. We're storytellers, so we want right. people to read our books and to have some entertainment to go along with the thought-provoking quality of a book.
Right. I think you have to reflect reality, and reality is not one note. Lastly, why don't you tell us where we can find you online so listeners can follow you on your social media accounts?
Okay, well, I'm really easy because everything is just under my name, Jodi Casella. I do have a website and I write a blog that I keep up with pretty regularly. I interview other writers. I also am on Twitter as Jodi Casella. I have a Facebook author page.
Spell your name for us so that okay. people can find you.
Okay, it's Jodi Casella, Casella.
Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire is produced by Mindy McGinnis. Music by Jack Corbel. A special thank you to fellow authors Alyssa Palombo and R.C. Lewis, as well as patron Stephen Avery for helping to make this episode possible. If you find the blog or podcast helpful, please consider showing your support by visiting patron.podbean.com/writer writer pants on fire and making a donation. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Writer Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist.